This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief at the New Books Network, and just a warning about the following interview. We had a bad phone connection, and so the audio is a little bit rough. But in any case, I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is.
And welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Dhara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. Our guest today is Justin Jones, lecturer in South Asian History at the University of Exeter, and he's going to be talking to us about his book, Shia Islam in Colonial India, Religion, Community and Sectarianism. This is as much a book about Lucknow and Oudh, the region of which it was the capital, as it is about Shiism. The Nawabs of Lucknow created one of the world's most significant post-Safavid Shia kingdoms. The kingdom ended with the 1856 deposition of Wajid Ali Shah. But Shiism, though deprived of the state patronage, which had enabled the growth of an entire cultural ecosystem, survived and evolved, engaging along the way, not just with the other sects of Indian Islam, but with the world at large.
Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
Thank you for doing this for the New Books Network, and it's a pleasure to have you talk to us today.
Well, no, thank you very much for inviting me to speak. I'm very pleased.
Oh, that's great. To start off with, could you just tell us something about yourself and, you know, your research?
Sure. Well, I'm currently a lecturer in history, or South Asian history, at the University of Exeter in the UK. My research is mostly linked to Islamic history in South Asia, looking primarily at the late 19th and 20th centuries. Most of my work has been centred really on North India, so I've done most of my field work in UP, cities like Lucknow, Aligarh and so on, and looking at the reformist tradition in that area. So my book obviously was published most of a year ago now, so that research is sort of completed, though I still continue to maintain an interest in its subject, and I'm working on other areas concerning Islam in that region.
What's the book about?
The book is basically about the Shia community of North India. It looks primarily at the region of Lucknow and the surrounding region of Awadh. So it's primarily a kind of local history, looking in depth at a particular religious community. The reason for picking that Shia community as the basis of analysis is that that region was under Shia rule from the 18th century up until the rebellion of 1856, 1857. So the community there was always one of the most influential in Indian Shiism generally, and certainly considers itself to be a leading bastion of the religion in the subcontinent. So what the book does is it picks up, the story of Shiism after 1847, when, of course, you have then the demise of the old Shia rulers, the Nawabs, the subjection to colonial rule. And so the sense has always existed in scholarship that Shiism thereafter goes into decline, that, you know, the patronage networks dry up, there's no longer the kind of state support for Shiism that there once was, and so there's been the sense that it goes into fading. And I've tried to argue instead that what you see is a kind of reconstruction of what Shiism is and how it works as a religion. So the book's kind of central theme is how Shiism turns from this kind of, if you like, a kind of state-linked religion, one about the ideas of governance, the one about a sort of sense of high culture, of Sharif norms and so on, into something much more systematic and much more universalistic. So the idea of Shiism existing as a religion linked to, but quite identifiable from, the sort of surrounding cultural setting in which it exists. So that's one of the big themes of the book. And the other one that's tied in with that is a study of sectarianism, which I sort of take to mean different kinds of Shia-Sunni conflicts. And the sense has often existed in literature, of course, that sectarianism in the colonial period is somehow incidental, or it's not that important. Because, of course, historiography has always emphasized Hindu-Muslim conflicts as being the kind of prime, the most consequential form of communal conflict in colonial India, for obvious reasons. But But I've tried to instead look at some of the theory that's been applied to communalism and look more in depth at Shia Sunni conflicts and how they evolve. And the kind of theme of the book is that you can't separate the study of Shiism and sort of the internal working of changes within Shiism from sectarianism. So it's about the links between the two, which I'll sort of talk about later in the interview, I guess. So it's got this two-pronged approach of looking at Shiism and the kinds of reconstruction of religion, but also looking at the way in which that entrenches or systematizes forms of conflict as well.
Going back to, you know, the start of the book, and you mentioned that the Shia community was associated with, the ruling house in, Lucknow. So how did that actually happen?
How did Shiism?
Yeah, because as I understand, the state of Lucknow, or let's say the Nawabs of Agra, they were primarily, viceroys of the Mughals.
Yeah.
So, and the Mughals were basically Sunni Muslims, so how did they manage to, achieve a position of, being influential?
Oh, well, that's long before the book starts. But essentially, the state of Awad evolves, it becomes a kind of vassal state of the Mughal Empire from its foundation in 1722. So it's indicative of the kind of wider fracturing of the Mughal Empire through the 18th century into various regional states. So really the political peak of Awad is in the late 18th century. And after that, it essentially becomes more and more under the influence of the East India Company. And obviously, it's sort of drawn into the same kind of treaties of trade and protection as are many of the regional states during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. I guess of most relevance for the book is the evolution in the early part of the 19th century of the state of Awad into a much more theocratic Shia-influenced state. So under the later Nawabs, especially kings like Amjad Ali Shah, you have the establishment of a Shia judiciary, you have the construction of Shia schools as a way of influencing the actual governance of the state. And so the state has moved away from being a sort of more kind of courtly, Mughal-influenced Persianate state into something much more distinctly Shia in its workings. And so that's sort of why the story is interesting, because on the point of annexation in the 1850s, you've got the state being under the most explicitly Shia political influence that it's been under since its creation, really. And so the book is taking up that question of what happens to, for example, the Shia scholars who've been built up as jurisconsults, as state educators, as waqf trustees, as courtly advisors, and what actually happens to them when they're disenfranchised of their own roles. And the basic argument that the book puts forward is that they are quite successful in, if you like, recrafting their roles and their purpose. They evolve from being these state functionaries instead of being the kind of representative of community. So they become engaged with the Shia community, they talk about representation, the need for keeping Shia institutions alive. They start to reach out to the community through public forums, through sort of social organizations, what are called andamans, and in terms of a kind of sort of lay proselytization as well, to instruct the public on the tenets of their religion. So that's a very roundabout answer to your question, but basically the book is taking up that question of what happens after the collapse of this Shia theocracy, this sort of Shia state, and sort of how that evolves into a more kind of public and a kind of engagement with the urban public sphere as a way of keeping the religion alive.
So what in fact was the impact of, the annexation of Awad? I mean, you do mention that there is a certain financial impact, but from what you just said, that there wasn't that much of an adverse impact, culturally speaking.
Yeah. I mean, the impact is huge. I mean, to start with, on the point of annexation, Shiism undoubtedly goes through a huge decline, which lasts for really probably a good 20 or 30 years. I mean, in even the city of Lucknow, you have the taking over by the colonial state of many of the key religious institutions. You have the, of course, many of the old courtly elite who had been sort of very much tied to the state were basically became pensioners of the colonial state, and so they sort of get drawn into, they lose a lot of their wealth and their social significance. So you do have this decline, but it's really from about the 1880s when you start to see much more of a reconstruction. So to give you a few examples of how things change, you've got the formation of madrasas, explicitly Shia religious schools in the state. There have been Shia religious schools in Awadh, but most of the significant ones had closed down on the point of annexation because the madrasas were there to serve the state, so when the state ceased to exist, the madrasas ceased to exist as well. So the ones existing from about the 1880s are very different. They're founded on, if you like, kind of voluntary donations, on the activities of particular scholars in the city. Likewise, the mujtahids in India, again, these have been state functionaries. Their role is very subdued from 1857. So many of them return to their kasbas, their kind of hometowns outside of Lucknow. Many of them actually go on long spells of learning and ziyarat in Iraq. They essentially go into a kind of self-imposed exile because the political climate in North India is so hostile. So it's from, again, about the 1880s that you start to see them being able to recraft some of their old significance, not just through madrasas, but also through public organizations, through their new access to printing. And so they're recrafting their role as these kind of public public teachers, public spokesmen, and sort of crafting a new kind of temporal relevance. So there is this decline, but what the book really takes up is not the decline so much, but the kind of the forms of the reconstruction from about the 1880s in the construction of new religious institutions, and with that kind of new forms of public and popular religion as well, which come out of that, as well as kind of a whole new kind of network of social institutions which start to come up from about the 1880s. So, for example, you start to see the formation of new organizations, the most important of which is the Shia Conference, which comes up in the 1900s. Attached to that is this whole array of Shia foundations, you know, charities, schools, things like kind of Muharram associations, which regulate religious festivals for the Shia, things like charities like orphanages, groups for the protection of groups like widows and so on. So you have this huge kind of network. I call it a process of Anjuman building, really, taking up this idea of kind of, you know, public organization and social service, which was quite common to many communities and nationalist groups around about this period. So you've got Shiism being completely reconstructed, and the whole look and the whole working is something very different from that you see pre-annexation. So this is why I sort of talk about how we can't talk about this as a mere religious revival. This is about the reconstruction of something completely new and something much more systematic.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, after the annexation, a lot of these scholars either went back to their hometowns or they went, you know, to Iran for further training. So how did this actually affect the links of the South Asian Shia world with, you know, the Persian Shia world? Because you've written a lot about that.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the arguments that I take up in the book is this idea that, how to put this, a lot of literature on Shiism in the 19th and 20th century has taken it in a very kind of global or transnational mode of working. I'm thinking in particular of, well, not just Juan Cole's work, which has been the most influential on, of course, Indian Shiism, but scholars who've worked on, say, Iraq, like Chibli Malut, who talks about this idea of a Shia international, that the Shia world is completely linked up by these international networks. And in the 19th and early 20th centuries, they're primarily centered in southern Iraq. The city of Najaf in particular, which is a big centre not just of learning but of pilgrimage as well because of the shrines there. The argument of the book really is to say that these global networks aren't everything. There's always been this slight sense of seeing the Indian Shia as existing on the periphery of the, if you like, a kind of global Shia network. And arguably this isn't really the case. And what we see in the period that I'm talking about isn't just a kind of internationalization, it's not just a story of globalization, but you've got instead this kind of counter development of a kind of Indianization of Shiism, a much greater kind of consciousness of what it means to be an Indian Shia, and for Shiism to work within its Indian setting. So there's this sense of the Indian Shia not existing on the periphery of the Shia world, but actually having a kind of autonomous and meaningful role within a kind of global religious network, if you see what I mean. So one example, again, to come back to is the idea of the madrasa. Now, in Nawabi Awadh, the madrasas were primarily built upon an educational prototype linked very strongly to Iraq. What we see in the late 19th century is the new schools actually have a much more Indianized curriculum. A lot of the books they're teaching from are of Indian genesis. The teachers within them are primarily Indian, and the networks of students visiting them are primarily Indian as well. So there are these connections with Iraq in particular, but these schools are really sort of constructing, if you like, an autonomous form of Indian Shiism in that part of the world. Likewise, things like popular religion in India. We have in the late 19th, early 20th centuries a huge renewal of a religious custom called Taziadari, which is the parading of, models of tombs. Hussein's tomb during Muharram is processed through the streets of towns like Lucknow. Many of them are sort of buried in these sort of mock recreations of the Karbala tragedy. So these are very distinctly Indian customs, and during this period they're actually being exported around the world by Indian indentured labourers and so on, but they're very much associated with the kind of Indian Shiism. So again, you've got this renewal of a distinctly kind of indigenous form of Shiism. What other examples? Likewise, things like Waqf endowments, these huge endowments left behind by the Nawab as ways of sort of ensuring the ongoing funding and patronage of Shiism. A lot of money had always gone from Awad to Iraq, but what we see during this period is that Indian scholars in Lucknow are trying to put much more Indian influence over how the money is spent. So there's almost this kind of attempt to ensure that these funds are Indianized. They are run by Indian scholars, and they're kept for Indian students and pilgrims in Iraq. So I guess the point of the book, or one of the points of the book, is to show that Shiism isn't simply this kind of global religion tied together by transnational networks and led from Iraq. It's something much more complex. And the story of this book is that as this new consciousness of Indian Shiism comes about, you have this kind of counter-movement. So we shouldn't just think in terms of these transnational links, but in terms of the kind of reinforcement of distinctly of regional understandings of the religion as well.
So you would say that Indian Shias were actually pretty influential, because you mentioned that they accounted for something like 3% of the total population. And so in a way they kind of formed, a ruling elite or something, and this was probably not the case with, Shias worldwide, well, except obviously for the Persian world. So, how did this, actually affect the position within the Islamic spectrum?
Within India, you mean?
Yeah, within India, or even, maybe globally. How were they perceived, the Indian Shias? Because they were obviously, pretty powerful.
Sure. The book sort of takes up this question of, this 3% figure, this idea of the minority. In the kind of, the census that the British government took from about the 1870s, they're very kind of rigid on working out who is a Shia, who is a Sunni, and who is a Sayyid, and who is a Sheikh, and all the rest of it. Part of what the book is arguing is that these statistics only really mean something in a colonial context. Prior to 1857, Shiism hadn't been that easily identifiable as a sort of segmented, easily compartmentalized religion, because of course it had been always very much associated with the state. And that meant, on the one hand, that a lot of distinctly Shia customs had a much wider cultural influence, even outside of communities who didn't see themselves as explicitly Shia. So to give you some examples, things like the Muharram festival, which has always been this kind of bedrock of Shia identity and Shia self-understanding, that in India always was and still is participated in by numerous communities. In the region of, in, say, Lucknow itself, many Hindus participate in this, some Sunnis do as well. In some of the kind of rural townships of Awadh, you even have kind of Sunnis taking charge of Muharram. So it was never, although it's of Shia origin, it was never an exclusively Shia festival as such. It was always something much more cosmopolitan, much more ecumenical. The same applies with the veneration of the imams. Imams like Ali and Hassan and Hussein. Now, many of the Sufi orders in India, groups like the Chishtiya, some of the big Sufi tariqas, the orders which exist and thrive across the subcontinent, they trace their origins to the imams. And many of the saints in India are direct descendants of the imams. So even, Sufis and Shia tend to be quite sort of separable in terms of who they are, but you've got these common cultural roots, and if you look at a lot of the literatures coming out of these traditions, a lot of the customs, there are these huge overlaps. So I guess one of the things that the book indicates is that the idea that the Shia are somehow separate and exclusive is something that comes out of the colonial context, not just because of the demise of sheer power, which means that, of course, the cultural influence doesn't have the same resonance that it once did, but also because there is this attempt to separate out these customs and cultures and traditions and all the rest. And the colonial state is doing this, but equally the population is doing this as well. So that's why this 3% figure becomes, if you like, something of a, you know, it's very much a new construct. It would have very little meaning before the 1870s, 1880s, when these things were put in place. And so as a sort of result of this, you do have this attempt among Muslim communities to separate themselves and work out who they are. You know, there's this attempt by the Shia to, if you like, to shore up their own identity, to make sure that their traditions are quite separable and identifiably different from Sunni traditions. Likewise, among Sunni communities, you have, you know, an attempt to sort of separate those influences from the scene of being of Shia origin, particularly among Sunni movements like, say, the Deobandi movement or the Bareilly movement, these huge reformist movements coming up in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. So this is where you start to get these kind of these schisms and this sense of difference coming about between these communities. And so these are really quite new to the period in question. These are sort of conflicts and questions and debates which are coming about in a colonial context rather than a pre-colonial context. And so I guess in regards to your question in a roundabout way, I guess this idea of the Shia as a minority is something that is quite new in this period. It's something that had very little meaning before the 1860s. And much of the book is trying to work out how the Shia start to sort of, how they try and work out their own strategies in this context of being a minority, how they attempt to shore up their own religious identity, how they try to protect themselves as a minority, and how they attempt to define themselves. But these are debates which are very new in the colonial period.
So, I mean, how does the colonial state actually attempt to, you know, organize and codify all the many kinds of Islams in India? I mean, probably that actually affected, you know, I don't know, intersect relations, you know, within the different Muslim communities in India, because, like, I'm thinking, for example, in terms of law, I mean, a lot of Muslim law that was codified, I mean, it was probably based on, you know, Hanafi Sunni law, and these guys would probably have had their own customs and things. So what was the impact of, I don't know, the colonial state trying to, you know, superimpose itself?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, the colonial state always has this, as always, it tends to see India in the truth that we know of well. It sees India as this sort of innately kind of religious and unchanging and spiritually focused society. So through the 19th century, you do have these sort of quite intense attempts to work out what's different between the Shia and the Sunni. I mean, you're quite right about the idea of law, which I don't talk about in the book. I'll happily talk about this. But of course, Hanafi law becomes the kind of bedrock of the whole personal law system that the British are constructing through the 19th century. In terms of how the British actually use the Shia-Sunni divide, of course, in one sense, the British see it as less important. I mean, of course, the main sort of concern for the British in North India is understanding what they see as a Muslim community in North India. And so the movements in the late 19th century, like the Aligarh movement, for example, all of these are attempts by the British to separate, if you like, a kind of Muslim minority from the wider kind of Hindu majority. And it sort of shows how they see the Hindu-Muslim divide or difference as much more consequential than the Shia-Sunni ones to start with. The same, of course, applies to the separate electorate system, which emerges in the late 19th, and particularly in the 20th century. Things like the Mori Minto reforms and the Montague Chelmsford reforms. So you've got the attempt to shore up a Muslim political identity in India, which has been well documented, thinking of Francis Robinson's work and all the rest of it. And of course, you know, the strategy here was the idea that the Muslim minority in India would be quite easily co-opted by the colonial state because it was a minority and because it always had these sort of links to sort of, you know, Mughal elitism and governance and all the rest of it. What the book really argues is that this wasn't the whole story. And there was a much more complex process going on than merely this attempt to shore up a Muslim minority identity, which is what's been documented. And what the book argues, especially in its third and fourth chapters, is that the colonial state at various points starts to dabble with the Shia-Sunni difference for political reasons. So much of the colonial state had always played off this idea of Hindu-Muslim identity and had played on particular communal fears as a way of shoring up Muslim loyalty in North India. So they start to do the same with the Shia-Sunni difference. So I'll give you a few examples of this. The 1910s in particular were a decade when you have the construction of a kind of Muslim agitationalist politics in North India. So you have the move from, again, Peter Robinson's work, the move from a kind of loyalist old party group who dominated Muslim politics to a what is called a young party, a younger agitationist group who are much more closely allied with a kind of Congressite ideology of protest and opposition. Now, the colonial state starts to see that there's sort of capital to be earned out of the Shia-Sunni difference here. So, for example, in the 1910s, you have you start to see a Shia-Sunni row taking place in Aligarh College. A number of Shia students and staff in the college start to say that the college is primarily Sunni in its orientation, that Sunni staff and students have a better settlement there, that the college can't kind of protect the rights of the Shia minority. And the colonial state really jumps on this bandwagon, and they start to help a number of Shia in Lucknow set up an alternative Shia college. Now, this Shia college is eventually established after the end of the war, so in about 1918-1919. It's set up under this language of, you know, sort of proximity to Aligarh, that the college is essentially created on the same sort of educational model, this sort of modernist education as Aligarh was. But the actual sort of way in which the college is set up is obviously one that is designed to stoke Shia-Sunni antagonism and to separate sort of the Shia project of educational reform and consolidation from the kind of Aligarh model. And if you look at the language of a lot of the administrators and many of the Shia scholars who are setting up this college, it's quite obvious that the Shia college is set up in a kind of as a kind of, you know, antagonizer rather than something set up on the model of Aligarh itself. Another example is the whole language of jihad and anti-colonial agitation, which is coming about in the 1910s. Now, again, the colonial state is quite sort of proximate to this, but the colonial state is quite successful in ensuring that many Shia disassociate themselves from, for example, the Kanpur Mosque agitation of 1913, which was this huge anti-colonial movement in UP. The key example perhaps is Pan-Islam, which is growing in these years. You have the beginning of the Pan-Islamic agitation at the hands of the Ali brothers, Muhammad and Shaukat Ali. You have the Khilafat movement emerging around about 1918-1919, which is, you know, to date the biggest anti-colonial Muslim agitation in India. And it's usually been assumed that the Shia were sort of involved in these. And to a degree, that's true. But on the other hand, you have this very powerful Shia counter-reaction to these movements. Many Shia associations in North India at this point are distancing themselves from the Ali brothers. I mean, the irony here is that the Ali brothers themselves were of partially Shia background. But nevertheless, and despite many Shia being involved in these movements, you have this this very distinct Shia counter-reaction to Pan-Islam. So you have certain Shia newspapers put forward the idea that British rule in the Middle East is far preferable to that of the Ottomans. You have these rumours being spread that the Ottomans are, if you like, kind of overtaking the treasures of Najaf and Karbala, so they're sort of very sort of anti-Shia in their actions. So that you have these Shia protests being organised against the Ottoman Empire and Ottoman rule in these territories. And even in the Khilafat movement, I mean, the Shia do participate in this, but they participate very late. It's only really in about 1921 that the Shia in North India are involving themselves in the Khilafat movement, which is really when the movement is starting to go into decline itself. So Shia entry is very late. And prior to that, many of the mujtahids, the highest scholars in Shia Islam, are opposing it. In 1920, they tell their community not to involve themselves with the Khilafat movement. And again, this is something that is done quite heavily with British support and co-option. The British are very keen on keeping, you know, loyal Shia politicians on side. They tell the Shia that the Shia have no concern with the Khilafat movement because this is an essentially Sunni-led agitation inspired by Sunni ideals. And they do this very successfully. So the point here is that the British do make really strong capital out of the Shia-Sunni difference in the 1910s and even into the 1920s. So this is a story that's not really been told. It's really been subsumed under the usual language of, you know, the construction of a Muslim minority identity, and at that point the kind of loyalty of this Muslim minority to the British state as the best guarantor of Muslim minority interests. But I argue that actually something much more complex is going on here, and that at points the British are using the Shia-Sunni difference just as successfully as they're making capital out of the Hindu-Muslim difference at particular points and in particular local contexts.
So, you know, this just occurred to me actually. You were talking about, you know, the Khilafah movement, and obviously the Shia wouldn't have participated, but there was this big effort, you know, by the Indian National Congress to sort of, you know, also get into the Khilafah movement, you know, the sort of Hindu-Muslim solidarity. So how did actually this have an impact on, you know, Shia and Hindu relations?
Shia-Hindu relations? This isn't talked about a great deal in the book, but I'll elaborate as far as I can. As a general political rule, the Shia tend to associate themselves much more closely with the Congress than with the Muslim League. This is much more pertinent after the Khilafat movement, because of course the Muslim League and the Congress are working together quite closely from about 1916 until the end, until sort of 1922 or so. Thereafter, the Shia start to pull themselves more closely to the Congress, and this applies actually particularly after about 1937, when of course the League and the Congress essentially completely sever their ties and act as opposing political parties. So key Shia political leaders, individuals like Wazir Hassan, who was a big Congress politician, carry the Shia closer to the Congress through organizations like the Shia Political Conference, which is essentially a Shia political body, which ensures that through the 1940s, the Shia in UPL largely keep a distance from the Muslim League and associate much more closely with the Congress. This is always, of course, very fractured and divided. Some of the key Muslim League politicians of the 1940s, thinking of individuals like the Raja Mahmudabad, who was sort of the League's major benefactor, they were Shia, but they were very much tied to the Muslim League. So, you know, as always, you don't get a sort of clear answer to this, but you do get the sense that there is this huge fracture and the sense that many Shia maintained a loyalty to the Congress long after the Muslim League has sort of, homogenized its grip on the wider kind of Muslim vote. In terms of relations with Hindus, which is obviously quite distinct from that, you do at points have moments when the Shia do try to align themselves with a nominal Hindu community much more closely, if you like, as a kind of counterbalance to a Sunni-dominated Muslim majoritarianism. So to give you a few examples, at various points in the 1900s, 1930s, 1940s as well, you have the Shia starting to sort of build these strong links with the Dalit community, the untouchable community, which is kind of an unpredictable link, if you like. But for example, through the 1910s to the 1920s, you have certain Shia mujtahids taking up the cause of the untouchables, saying that it's perfectly legitimate for Muslims to dine with untouchables, to share the same wells, and so on. By extension, associating themselves with the kind of Gandhian language of uplift and communal betterment, which is, of course, is growing at this time. By about the 1930s, 1940s, you have many Shia politicians talking talking in a similar language, really, to the demands of untouchables for their own political recognition and their need for sort of a political entity or an electorate system within the sort of eventual constitutional makeup of India. Now, I don't really talk about this in the book as much as I would have liked to have done for want of space, really, but this Shia untouchable nexus is perceptible at various points, and of course it's quite unusual because the Shia are simultaneously trying to associate themselves with the idea of being, if you like, of very noble origins. Most Shia in North India are Saids, they're direct descendants of the Prophet. Many of them are continuing to really craft themselves in terms of the language of aristocracy. They're kind of high birth, which they're using to distinguish themselves from the wider Sunni community. So this attempt to associate themselves with the kind of downtrodden in Hinduism is quite unusual and something quite interesting. And it really shows, if anything, the reason must be because the Shia are trying to craft themselves within, as if you like, a kind of oppressed minority within Islam, in the same way as the Untouchables are trying to craft themselves as a kind of oppressed minority within Hinduism. The implication being the same, that the Dalits need to be considered not as Hindus, but as a kind of separate community whose rights need to be protected by the state outside of Hinduism. Likewise, the Shia are arguing that they need to have their rights protected by the state outside of a kind of wider sort of Muslim political identity. Following on from that, you have into the 1930s, 1940s, various sort of examples. So again, this isn't in the book, which is a shame, but there wasn't space. But things like, Shia support for the cow protection movement, which happens in the 1930s, which, again, it's politically opportunistic, but it's an attempt to sort of separate the Shia political agenda from a Sunni one. And this is taking place around about the time of what I talk about in chapter 5 of the book, which is the Tabra agitation, which is this huge Shia agitation which takes place in the 1930s. And during that, many sort of Hindu spokesmen are offering their support to the Shia as well, that the Shia ought to have the political rights to maintain their sort of religious customs and so on. So you do, at political, a particular point, see this sort of opportunistic link between a kind of Shia political identity and a Hindu, or at some points even an untouchable political identity. But these links tend to be very fluid and very opportunistic. So they're not consistent, but they're ones that arise at particular moments when the Shia community is trying to assert its own need for political recognition.
That's fascinating. I was just wondering, what were the links of the North Indian Shia community with, the Shias in the South?
Again, that's very interesting. And it depends really on which side you ask from. Of course, in South India, you have a hugely interesting and important Shia minority, which is clustered around the old sultanates of Bijapur and Golconda, and eventually the state of Hyderabad, which, while it wasn't a Shia state in the same way as Awadh was, nevertheless had a very strong Shia influence, and its cultural institutions, or Shia cultural institutions there, always were and remain very vigorous. Now, the links are, they're sort of interesting and complex, and again, because this book is very much a kind of North India-centered study, it doesn't look at them in quite the same way, but I'll elaborate as far as I can. The North India Shia always try and see themselves as, if you like, the kind of guardians of Shiism. So what always really surprised me about the sources I looked at for this study were how far the sources, well, firstly, how, if you like, neglectful they are of specific Shia, of specific reference to the Shia of the South. It's actually relatively rare to see detailed kind of interrogations or, studies of Hyderabad, for example, in North Indian religious texts. But at the same time, the North Indian texts are talking about this of the Shia community as being Hindustani, and they're using this language of a Shia form, which, of course, is a sort of term which indicates kind of wider Indianness. So the point here is that the North Indian Shia are, if you like, sort of talk about themselves in this language of Indianness, of being a complete sort of subcontinental identity. At the same time, they're not really engaging the South in any substantive way. What we do occasionally get is a sense of traffic between the two. After the annexation of Awadh, you have a lot of the North Indian staff of the court move to Hyderabad and take up work there with the administrators and the officials of the Nizam. So those links sort of maintain their work. You have a lot of Hyderabadi scholars who sort of visit North India for learning. Again, the madrasas discussed in the book seem to have quite a number of Hyderabadi students and students from all over India. Again, you've got organizations like the All India Shia Conference, which is essentially a kind of, a brainchild of the Shia in Lucknow. They call it an All India Conference. They have some representatives from Hyderabad, from Chennai, from Bombay, from wherever. But again, the conference is largely kind of North Indian in its orientation, in the general kind of catchment area of its constituents, in the kind of themes it's taking up. So I guess the point of the book really is how the North Indian Shia are trying to craft themselves as being representative of a wider Indian Shiism, even though those links are quite incidental and quite sort of fragmented. And so, in a sense, what it shows is the kind of, if you like, the interrelations between, if you like, locality and nation, almost. In this sort of local context, you've got the Shia working on their own kind of, their own sort of, the kind of Lakhnawi networks, the sort of the renewal of Shiism in Awadh. But this language of Qom, of kind of a regional identity, is overlapping very heavily with this sense of a national Shiism as well. So in a roundabout answer to your question, the North Indian Shia were quite, always kind of talked about themselves as being Indian Shia, rather than simply North Indian Shia. And this was partly for sort of, the expedient political reasons of, trying to represent Shiism and how you need to be a national community in order to do that. But it's also about a kind of wider, kind of lingering sense of Lucknow's superiority and its kind of role within a wider Shiism. And so you have this residual sense of Lucknow being the kind of the centre of North Indian Shiism, even when perhaps it's becoming a much more complex story. You've got these other regional assertions of identity.
You mentioned out here, I think, in the bits about the Aligarh movement, that they were not all that happy, about Aligarh College, and they didn't, they were quite ambivalent about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, this is a story that hasn't really been taken up substantively in much literature, because the usual kind of Aligarh narrative, thinking of, the work by, David Ehrenfeld and so on, has been that Aligarh shored up this, if you like, this kind of cross-sectarian Muslim identity. The idea was that Aligarh would be a college for the Muslim elite of North India. It wouldn't distinguish on Shia, Sunni, or any other ground. It wouldn't take into account Shia-Sunni difference. Asad Ahmed Khan himself was one of these great reformers who talked about the need for Muslims to neglect or forget their sectarian differences and work together. So the usual narrative of Aligarh, as with that of the whole Muslim League and the whole narrative of Muslim separatism, has been that it sort of constructed this overarching Muslim identity in which the identity of sect or individual school didn't matter. And the book, I guess, argues that the opposite is the case, and that Aligarh becomes, not just Aligarh, but the wider kind of Muslim modernist project, becomes not a kind of cross-sectarian project, but actually a kind of Sunni-dominated modernist project, which cannot incorporate the needs of the Shia or other Muslim minorities. So to give you a few examples of how this works in practice, a lot of the key sort of personages of the Aligarh movement were seen by the Shia as being quite hostile to their needs. One example is Fikr al-Mulk, or Mushtaq Hussein, who, of course, for the Aligarh movement, was the secretary of Aligarh College in the early 20th century, but he was seen by many Shia as being a sort of virulent anti-Shia polemicist. He was based in Amroha, where he had made this name, really, as the kind of, the representative of the Sunnis on the local municipal board. So it's a much more complex story. And actually, if you look at a lot of the Aligarh-inspired modernist press in North India, what the book argues is that a lot of the kind of Aligarh activists were writing in this language of polemic against an old Muslim aristocracy, the kind of old courtly elite who could have modernized. And the reality was that a lot of this Muslim elite happened to be Shia. So the point is that this kind of Muslim modernist agenda is overlapping quite strongly with a kind of anti-Shia polemic. So, for example, a lot of articles written in the North Indian Urdu press talked about the backwards and unreformed Shia sides. The point here is that they are the old aristocracy, but as well they're being identified as Shia. So this simply serves to further push many Shia out of the Aligarh movement. And as I argue in the book, you have a sort of Shia kind of counter-reform movement, which is emphasizing the need for a Shia modernist education, but along separate lines. So the idea that the Shia need to sort of establish their own educational movements and schools. And you have several examples of this. Of course, you've got the Shia Conference, which is attempting to set up various Shia schools and groups around the province and indeed around India. You have distinctly Shia educational anjumans, public organizations coming into being. There's one called the Anjuman-e-Sadat-e Wazif-e-Mominin, like the association for the scholarship of the community, the leaders and the followers, which is distinctly Shia. And you've got the Shia College, which, while it is constructed under the language of modernist education, the whole point of it is that it comes about essentially out of hostility to Aligarh and out of the belief that the Shia can only safeguard their own interests in distinctly Shia educational institutions. So, while this isn't one of the key themes of the book, it's sort of confined to one chapter, I guess one of the implications of the book is that the Aligarh movement doesn't only exist as we've thought about it. It's not only a kind of it's not merely a kind of Muslim reformist movement, but actually it's seen by certain Muslim minorities as being unable to incorporate their own identity and as being a kind of Sunni majoritarian movement. So the take on Aligarh is quite sort of distinct. That is, incidentally, the theme that helped me get into this area of study. When I started this project, I was looking primarily at, say, the Aligarh movement and the Muslim League and sort of how that related to Muslim minority interests. And as the study evolved, I started to go much more into the kind of Shia angle of the study and looking much more about the kind of dialogues and dialectics within the Shia community. So this is, if you like, where the research started. And then the whole project that came out of it became very different and much more wide-ranging.
Talking about the research, how was it? I mean, what was the archival research like? Because you've used a lot of, like, you know, non-English sources, so how was it?
Sure. Again, when I started this research, I mean, this is a while ago now. This began as a doctoral thesis back from about 2003, I probably started. And it evolved also during a kind of postdoctoral fellowship. So it's, you know, over time it's changed its shape consistently and greatly. A lot of the research fit, you know, the idea to start with was to construct a largely political study, I guess, looking at the emergence of a Shia political identity, which would, of course, be based on archives, newspaper sources, and so on as well. But when I was on fieldwork, primarily in Lucknow, but also in other towns in UP, you know, Aligarh and Moradabad and other places like that, it seemed to me to become much more interesting to sort of work out the internal workings of the community. And this drew me much more closer to using Urdu sources. So a lot of the book is based on things like, what are called sort of rasail, tracts and treatises written by the community. So these include, kind of instructive tracts, tracts teaching the Shia community how to live and sort of how to behave as Muslims. They include sort of, literature about Muharram, books about how Muharram should be regulated, but also sort of compilations and writings about the Imams, Imam Hussein and Imam Ali, and this huge sort of wider kind of network of Urdu literature. So, what I think ultimately the book has tried to do is bring out this idea of a very vibrant kind of Urdu public sphere in North India. And this has never really been looked at for the Shia, and I guess part of the reason is that the Shia has always been seen as this kind of Persianate culture, sort of rooted in this, this sort of transnational traffic and sort of essentially communicating through Persian and so on. But really, of course, that's not the case. And most North Indian Shia would have been reading not in Persian, but in Urdu, or those who could read or who did read. So the book is trying to sort of show how Shiism is sort of evoked and understood and presented through Urdu literature. And of course, this links back to what I was saying earlier about the idea of sort of Indian Shia identity. You know, essentially the main medium of communication in North India was not Persian at all, but it was Urdu. So the thesis is really looking consistently at the kind of themes and almost the kind of language that is coming out and how Shiism is being presented. And so I look a lot at the kind of language. Again, I mentioned earlier this idea of how the Shia community is articulated and presented. And there is a change over the period. It's increasingly moving towards talking about the Shia in terms like Qom, you know, this idea of the Shia being a kind of easily identifiable and largely separate group. Now, to go back to fieldwork a bit, really, I started sort of working in archives, you know, working in Lucknow and Delhi and so on, but the more time I spent out there, the more it occurred to me that it became impossible to work on the Shia community as a whole. And really what I started to then try and do was sort of separate different sort of groups and factions within it. And the thing that really inspired me to do this was mixing with a lot of the Shia community within Lucknow itself. I mean, I won't mention any names, but when you talk to a number of the ulama who still work in Lucknow, many of whom are descended from the people who I talk about in the book, or when you talk about many of the Shia sort of secular leaders or the leaders of Shia secular institutions in Lucknow, the relations among them are generally, well, are often very sort of difficult. They're often very antagonistic and very competitive and often actually very hostile. And I felt that if I, as an outsider working in Lucknow, could get a sense of the kind of politics within the community, then how intense must it be actually for those working within it? So from that point, I really started to try and separate out, you know, the idea that the Shia community even existed. And I guess what the book is trying to do is that it's argued that there is no such thing as the Shia community at all. But what you've essentially got are these rival groups and these rival claims to influence within the community.
And all these groups are just trying to claim that they are like representative of the Shia community, I guess.
Pretty much. And I mean, one of the key arguments of the book in that regard, I haven't really talked about this today, but I look in the book a great deal at sectarianism and Shia Sunni conflict, and that was one of the main things I wanted to look at when I started doing the research for this. But the problem I really came across was that if there's no, you know, if the Shia community itself is so fractured and so riven with dispute and changing so much and so, you know, so hard to pin down, then how on earth can you talk about the Shia and the Sunni as in any way fixed communities? And so the argument about sectarianism in the book really is it's not to see it as a kind of result of a Shia religious revivalism or a Shia community consolidation, because the point is that this Shia community never is consolidated. And so I try to take up the argument that sectarianism or Shia-Sunni debate is really, it's not the result of something, but it's the kind of means to an end. That in a way the Shia are ongoing, you know, they're engaged in this ongoing process of dispute and debate and talking about what it means to be Shia and what the community is like. And one of the ways in which they do this is by, if you like, contrasting a Shiism with its opposite. So a lot of Shia-Sunni debate and dispute comes out of this attempt by the Shia to define themselves, to talk about what it means to be Shia, to sort of establish a kind of basis of community, which means a constant process of comparison with its opposite. Now, sort of further to that, one of the arguments of the book, which is taken up in all chapters, really, perhaps especially in Chapter 2 and Chapter 5, is that Shia-Sunni conflict is partly a result of conflict between different groups within Shiism itself. Because what you have is through the 20th century, well, late 19th, early 20th centuries, even up to today, really, you have this ongoing kind of attempt by particular Shia groups to establish their supremacy within the community, to establish their own leadership credentials. And part of the way in which they're always able to stake a claim is by, if you like, sectarian modes of communication, which are always good at getting, you know, they get sort of public coverage, they bring people to attention, you know, to always trying to say something a bit more controversial or to sort of push a particular religious ritual a bit further than anyone else, is a way of establishing a kind of leadership claim within the community. So my argument is that a lot of Shia-Sunni conflict comes about in this way, with particular Shia groups attempting to assert their own leadership role within Shiism, thereby adopting a sort of anti-Sunni language or form of practice as a way of doing this. Now, this, of course, works both ways. You know, I argue as well that you know, Sunni polemic against Shiism is very much rooted in the same thing, but the focus here is, of course, on the Shia community. And so the argument here is that you can't separate sectarianism from a study of how Shiism is changing in this period, which is why I've chosen to look at both together rather than just looking at Shiism or just looking at sectarianism.
Wow, we've covered a lot of ground here. You've taken up a lot of your time, but one final question, what are you working on currently?
Well, I mean, I continue to have some interest in Shiism. I'm continuing to work on a few sort of offshoots of stuff of material covered in the book. So I'm working in particular on a couple of articles at the moment which look at some of the key clerical families which are, who emerged from this book. I mean, this book, as I've emphasized, is very much a sort of community-centered narrative, but I'd like to look at some of the individual scholarly networks coming out of this study, and how they're changing, and how, you know, sort of how they're communicating, and how they changed the colonial period. As well as that, I'm looking at various other studies linked to the North Indian ulama and the North Indian Muslim community more widely. The bigger project I'm working on at the moment is on Muslim personal law in India and how that evolves, and the kind of codification project that comes out of the ulama during this period, I guess. Again, I got onto this subject through looking at the Shia and working with numerous groups in North India which currently exist, like the Shia Muslim Personal Law Board. I published an article on personal law in Modern Asian Studies in 2010, which is, again, is taking up a linked argument to the book, but looking at how sort of Shia groups and wider Muslim groups are interacting, but through the sort of realm of personal law as a kind of canvas on which these groups are asserting their own identities. So my hope in coming years is to develop this project on personal law in North India. I'm also looking increasingly at the Sunni ulama. I'm looking at groups like Deobandis, in particular in terms of the kind of religious revivalisms and reforms coming around in this period. And also I'm looking at sort of wider sort of Deobandi networks existing between North India and Afghanistan. But this is work that will take me a long way down the line at the moment. I mean, at the moment, I'm fairly new into a new teaching job, so I've been teaching quite heavily. So, you know, I've been working sort of on various articles and various interests, and I guess to some degree we'll see what develops out of that.
I'm sure you'd be great, and we'd love to have you back on the New Books Network, you know, whenever the next project is published. In the meantime, thanks very much for doing this for us.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Dara. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
So, Fox, a lovely talk with a very enthusiastic academic. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.